Hello, everyone. It's 1 p.m. Once again, time. Okay, popping. I heard that. All right, it's 1 p.m. May I have your attention, please? Let's see, you don't say pay attention. I think Mary told me that we don't say that here. Pay attention? I think it's an American thing. It's not rude. Really, it isn't. Okay. Any announcements or reminder? 7 p.m. dinner, not 6. If you show up here, you'll be put to work helping rearrange the room. Because that's what will be happening. Maria, microphone 1. Or roving 1.
Sorry. Roving 1?
Yes. Not roving 1, real 1.
Just 1. Just to remind people tonight to take all of your stuff with you. Don't leave it in the room and here. Because
Maria, I didn't understand what you said, so it's possible others didn't either.
So when we finish our session today, if people can pack up all of their equipment and their notes and bags
and take everything
with you tonight, so there's nothing left in this room, so they can set up for the dinner. A slightly embarrassing question that I have to ask, and the person, whoever did, can come and just see me. Who paid for the taxi from the museum back to the hotel? Because we would like to reimburse you. I don't know who it was, but please come and make yourself known. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, this afternoon is a kind of a technology afternoon. It's the technology day, more or less. So, what did you guys enjoy the hands-on exhibits?
Yes.
Good. I did too. It was wonderful. Thank you. James, we're going to hear from the Braille Technology Committee. Do you want to come up here or do you want to report from your table? James, you may do as you wish. If you'd prefer to report from there, that's okay. Okay. He's lost his notes. Do you don't just memorize this stuff in your sleep? Yeah, I think. Is that thunder? Ooh, New Zealand thunder. Sounds like American roadworks. Oh, yeah?
What's wrong?
The weirdest thunder I've ever seen was in Vienna, Austria, when it was snowing hard and thundering. It's like, that was totally bizarre. James?
Yeah, come this way. Sorry.
To your right? Back? To your right?
Here. Come back this way.
There you go.
Here it is. Now the joy is, can I read my notes? They're written in grade 3. plus custom abbreviations. So, what does it say? Oh yeah, so the Braille Technology Committee, officially I think it's the Braille Refreshable Braille Technology Committee, has representatives from all ICEB countries. I have to scrap that now because we don't yet have any members from Nepal. So if anybody in Nepal is interested in being the representative on the Refreshable Braille Technology Committee, please do drop me a line and we'll be delighted to have you. And we have about 30 observers, I think it is, in total. The focus from the Technology Committee has, in the last 4 years, been improving LibLui in various screen readers and braille displays. So we wrote a letter to various manufacturers back in the day to find out and make sure they were actually updating. LibLui actually gets updated every 3 months, but screen readers certainly weren't doing that at the beginning of the 4 years ago. I'm not going to repeat it particularly, but there was a lovely moment in the 2020 General Assembly when someone was complaining how bad LibLui was. Turned out the screen reader hadn't updated for years and years and years. But that's now been fixed, which is wonderful. So updating means that you can enjoy all the latest improvements and fixes and wonderful things and so on. And over the last 4 years, we have continued to improve LibLui, including adding more. This will sound completely esoteric, but really there is a purpose. Adding more accented letters, mathematical characters, and various contraction fixes, particularly words beginning B-E. Yes, I bit the bullet and tried the hardest contraction in the book, B-E, and there are thousands of words beginning with B-E. And yes, I did read through the entire dictionary, and yes, it was boring. And there's lots of words which you'll never, ever possibly come across. But occasionally, for that one user who will come across that word, it's important that, I don't know, be-aproned is not beeproned, you know. In the 2020, we gave I think it was my colleague Dave Williams, gave an entertaining presentation where we ran some text through an old version of LibLui, and it made all sorts of horrendous errors. And then we ran the same text through the modern version, and of course there were no errors. Okay, yes, we rigged the text, but it proves a point. In the 2022 midterm meeting, we discussed two questions specifically relating to LibLui, which were what to do with what we call in UEB spaced digits, and what to do about reverse translating dot three. So a spaced digit in UEB is when you put a dot five between two what we would normally consider as numbers, and it means there's a space in the print. And you're supposed to use that for long numbers which are considered a single entity. So, for example, an ISBN, 978 space 1 space. No, I'm not going to read an entire one, but you get the idea. And you're supposed to put dot fives between the various components. Unfortunately, LibLui was just taking any old space and two digits either side and sticking a dot five, regardless whether it was a single or a multiple entity number. So if you happen to have, for example, on your computer an MP3 file, which happened to be number 2 of 14, you would get MP3.52 of 14. So it looked like MP3.2 almost, which wasn't ideal. And also it affected UK postcodes. Postcodes in the UK start letter, letter, number, space, number, letter, letter. And you get those messed up nicely, and they looked awful. So hopefully that has gone in, now been fixed. And the discussion about the dot three, basically, when you reverse translate dot three, we all know it's an apostrophe, yeah, right? It's not a single quote, it's an apostrophe. Should it come out as Unicode 27, which is the ordinary apostrophe, or should it come out as the closed single quote 2019? It's almost the reverse of the discussion we had 4 years ago and more about what to do with the single quote. Should it be an apostrophe or a single quote? So things go round that come round, and hopefully those things have been fixed in the latest version of LibLui. If I recall, the latest version is 3.29, which was released this March. 3.30 is due next month, in beginning of June. I'm not aware of any UEB fixes this time round, but I am working on a huge, huge test file. Thank you, whoever wrote it. It was horrendous. And it's full of but, comma, space, but, semicolon, space, but, colon, space, but, dollar sign, space, but, percent sign, space, and all sorts of weird and wonderful combinations of strange characters and words which could be standing alone or letters which aren't standing alone, and it really does fry your brain if you're not careful. We are also, it's worth noting that part of the work trying to fix LibLui has raised all sorts of interesting questions, which of which some of them we pass on to the Code Maintenance Committee. For example, in looking through the word list in the dictionary, words beginning BE, I came across a word, below stairs, which happens to be perhaps a British thing back in the day when you used to have servants below stairs and the people of the house above stairs. Those two words are not currently in the short form extension list. Should they be? Question. We need to refer such questions. And of course, there's all sorts of weird and wonderful words. How should it be brailled? So we're very grateful to the Code Maintenance Committee for any help they have been able to offer. And I also want to say thank you to those people who have reviewed all sorts of crazy things which I've sent to you to review over those years. When you do work in LibLui, part of the way they ensure its correctness is you have to supply tests which you have to say, yes, these work or should work, or this is the way it should be. And then if all the tests pass, it's good. If they don't pass, they'll say, there's a problem here, guys. Now, these tests are interesting to write, but part of the really good thing about them is if you continue work afterwards, it's a surefire way to make sure you don't break anything. So there is, as part of the UEB test suite for LibLui, a dictionary harness test, which, believe it or not, contains over 100,000 words. And I believe majority of them, if not most of them, if not nearly all of them, actually translate properly into UEB. But there are, of course, questions about some things. So I've already mentioned about encouraging manufacturers to update. It's very encouraging to see the majority of them have done that, although some of them got back and said the product doesn't actually exist anymore. And we hope to perhaps maybe write to them again to continue to encourage them to be up to date. What else have we got here? I'd like to also highlight the excellent work by Duxbury Systems. They continue to implement improvements. Now, most of those are behind the scenes, and you won't notice them. But those who are in the know, they'll say, oh, yes, there's been a fix to a rare word in UEB. We sent out a request for suggestions to improve Duxbury. If anybody had any ideas of features and functions you want to see. And there were a couple of suggestions, but I would encourage everyone, if you have feedback to manufacturers, please give it. Don't just complain to your colleagues that it doesn't work. Don't just badmouth the software that it's rubbish. Go to the horse's mouth and tell them, we need this fixed. Feedback is welcome. And if you don't receive it, the manufacturers will carry on in their own sweet way. I've been there. You send something out to beta test and you say, is this working? You hear nothing. You think it's wonderful because you heard nothing back. You have to assume it's okay. And then 6 months down the line, everybody's saying, oh, it's rubbish software. It don't work. Don't do this. Well, why didn't you tell us? Please, please. So I'm pretty sure we can say that on behalf of all those who are here this morning, do give feedback. It is welcome and it is acted upon. We've also been very much watching with interest the eBraille project. We saw the presentation this morning from Willow and Greg. And it's continuing to evolve and continuing to work. Discussions are very much at the technical stage and lots of interesting topics being discussed and very technical details with lots of interesting letters and so on and so forth. I'm not going to go into it. I think we may hear more about that. We had a meeting in 2023 and we were joined by Willow, who gave a presentation about eBraille. And it was obvious then that not everybody had heard of it. So I'm hoping I'm not going to steal too much thunder, but I have an acronym, RING, R-I-N-G. R is for reflowable. So for those who have short Braille displays and long Braille files, you will possibly be aware of what I call long line, short line syndrome. If you have a 40-cell Braille BRF file and a 32-cell Braille display, HumanWare, I'm talking to you particularly, you get long line, short line syndrome. Please fix it. It's very easy to fix. But eBraille will fix it better because there will not be the problem in the first place. International is I. We're probably aware of the US ASCII encoding of Braille. And there are two of them, just to complicate matters, called uppercase and lowercase. And there was a question on the LibLui list even this morning about that. Not every country uses US ASCII encoding. If you were in Germany, for example, you'd use Euro encoding. If you were in France, you'd use French encoding, which means it's difficult to exchange Braille files, particularly between non-English speaking countries and English speaking countries. This is a problem particularly in the area of Braille music, where the code is universal, but the encoding is not. Oops. And there, surprisingly, isn't easily available software to do that simple conversion. It's really easy to convert these files, but there just isn't an easy piece of software to do it. Surprising but true. I mean, I did actually try and write something years ago when I was a student, but that software is definitely not roadworthy in the 21st century. N is the big one for me, navigation. If you're using a BRF file, your best friend is the find command, often space and F, but you need to know what you've got to look for. You could search for the word chapter and then find that your book doesn't actually have the word chapter in the chapter titles. It just has the letter or a Roman numeral or a word or a number. So what actually do you look for? And in the UK, we have these wonderful end markers, which are lines of .25 at the end of each chapter. So that's helpful, but it's not necessarily ideal. You can search for a print page number. In the UK, you could search for .5, .25, immediately followed by the page number. In Banner countries, you'd search for a huge long line of .36, followed by the page number. But again, it's not ideal because you need to know what you're looking for. So in eBraille, we hope there will be facilities and functions to jump to the next heading, the next paragraph, the next table, the next page, maybe next footnote. I don't know. All sorts of possibilities are available. They just haven't yet been nailed down. And G is for graphics, and we saw a demonstration of that on the Monarch this morning. Previously, if you had a Braille book, the graphics have to be packaged completely separately. A BRF file is just the text. And if you're producing a book which includes graphics, you had to maybe miss out a page number here and there, and then manually insert swell paper graphics in the right places when you actually assemble the book at production time. Hopefully, eBraille can solve that problem too. So we had all sorts of interesting discussions, and if you're interested in finding out more about the eBraille project, there's a nice long web address in the report at daisy.org. Effectively, you go to daisy.org, look at the projects page, and then find the Braille eBraille project. There was a 2020 resolution about encouraging manufacturers to improve and update and so on. I put to you that we have largely accomplished that resolution and made great strides in improving the Braille experience for many. We acknowledge there's still further work to do, but I'd like to thank everybody who's been involved thus far. Let's continue the flag flying. Thank you. That didn't take half an hour, did it? The questions might.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any ideas about...
Does anyone have any ideas about things that the Braille Technology Committee might work on? Oh, you're off the hook, James.
I resign now.
Gough.
Yes.
As a teacher, I often have to make applications and trials for learners who are going to be using electronic Braille devices. And I only know what I know. And I'm lucky that I have some good contacts who I can also talk to about new things that are coming out. But it would be really useful if there was some kind of database, if you come from kinds of places that say that, that had, or a spreadsheet that had all of the available Braille devices on it that could be added to by anybody who had a new one, with some information on those devices and maybe space for a comment from a user, a comment from a teacher, anybody who was using one who was prepared to talk to somebody else, leaving their email address, something along those lines that we could all access. And I'm just wondering if that would be an appropriate kind of project for this subcommittee.
Interesting idea.
It's coming. How are you going, Amanda? I thought I'd just answer that. It's Scott Erickson. I've actually written one. It's kind of... I mean, I don't know how up to date, I'll double check, but I wrote one a couple of years ago for this exact same kind of reason.
I can't hear you.
I can't understand you.
Oh. Speak up.
Hello. There we go. So I've actually written one. I was asked to write one a few years ago for Australia, for something in Australia that we did. So I've got a spreadsheet which I can send you. I can update it and send it to you. I might send it to you, James, as well, and we can coordinate and work on it.
Well, we'll have a look at it and...
Yeah,
and
cool.
It starts getting a little more complicated than you might think when you start trying to make a comprehensive list of Braille displays because, you know, how far back in time do we go? How many different versions? With what operating system? It goes on and on. So it's not quite as straightforward as it might sound.
It's even more complicated if you start factoring in different countries.
Yes.
So I would almost back that back to the local Braille authority, because then and the local blindness agencies, because then you can have local information. If you, for example, talk to, oh, I don't know, I'm going to pick on HumanWare, but I don't mean this negatively. HumanWare, you can download books directly from NLS and Bookshare. That's great if you're in US. In the UK, we don't have NLS. It's no use at all. So you get a completely different opinion depending which country you're on. Now, it's great you can download books, and the shortcoming is that we can't access NLS. It's nothing to do with HumanWare. It's the country we're in that's the problem, not the device in that particular case. So you will get mixed opinions as well.
I've got a microphone. There we go. I just wanted to follow on. I agree with that. I just wanted to follow on from what Scott was saying about his resource. Some time ago, Mosen Consulting published a book by Jackie Brown called Braille on Display, which tried to do some of this. And it sort of speaks to what we've been saying, really. Braille on Display is now quite dated, and it became dated very quickly. I don't know whether I'm supposed to say or not, but I'll say it. Jackie is currently working on an update to that book, which is expected to be released in the next little while. I don't want to put a timescale on it, but it'll be updated, and that may be a useful resource. But again, how long it will stay current, I'm not sure.
Maybe the best thing we could do is put together a resource list for what exists in various countries and various places. Christo first. Christo.
James has given us a wish list here of what eBraille should do. We've had the wish list for some years now. When could we expect the wish list to become reality? And then, is eBraille supposed to do what the PEF format was supposed to do? And is that dead? Is it still alive? Is it being continued?
Is eBraille supposed to be like PDF? No.
eBraille is in the next session, so why don't we...
eBraille is more like EPUB.
Why don't we hold the eBraille discussion until the next session? Donna, but you could answer the first part of Christo's question.
Remind me?
The wish list.
Wish list. Christo.
When does the wish list become reality?
Where?
When?
When? I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question. When
will the wish list become a reality?
What wish list?
The wish list you mentioned, things you would like to see eBraille do.
Oh, well, you need to talk to the manufacturers. You need to talk to the manufacturers. I'm saying give feedback to manufacturers. You know, they ask for suggestions. Obviously, that's their roadmap for development. I can't influence that. But of course, you know, the more people who ask for stuff, in some ways, the better. And in other ways, they have to prioritize features.
Hey, Jennifer Dunham, United States.
Yes. A couple of ideas will come forward tomorrow in my presentation, but one I wanted to highlight is about reporting mechanisms. Certainly, the only way to fix things is to have them reported. Between the various manufacturers, the various Liblui avenues, would there be some way for the technology committee to provide some coordinated information on the most effective places to report things?
Yes, I can answer that one. There are two main Braille table products, I would say. Duxbury is one and Liblui is the other. There are others, but those are the two main ones. For problems with Duxbury, you talk to Duxbury Systems, go to their website. And for Liblui, you go to their website. And I mean, it's...
Follow up.
I don't mean to speak to, you know, it's... but there is what they call a GitHub tracker, which is a fancy computer-easy kind of way of saying that's where you should report problems. There is also a mailing list for LibLui. Details are on the LibLui website, and I'll give the LibLui website. It's liblui.io.
Liblui.io.
And the Duxbury address is duxburysystems.com.
Follow up?
Yes?
Thank you for that specific answer, James. There are other issues around Braille display technology that sometimes need attention, and it's hard to know where to report them, such as interface issues and things not working. Rather than a specific list here, because we're here and we know who to ask, would there be some way for the technology committee to create a document that would be available to more people than beyond those who are on the stream or in the room?
Well, we can ask manufacturers, but we can't actually make them do anything.
No, and again, this is about making information available, helping so that we get beyond the complaining stage and get to the reporting stage for people. Thank you.
Thank you.
There you go. Yeah, I just wanted to second that, Jennifer. I think I get what you mean. Some sort of document that says to report a problem with JAWS, then go to this place. To report a problem with LibLui, go to this place. And perhaps some instructions maybe on how to do it and because some of the bug tracker fields, they might be accessible, but you might not understand what information is actually required in those fields. You know, how do you describe accurately what some of these weird translation problems are? So I would certainly be in favor of the technology committee coming up with some sort of tutorial document / reference document on where all these bug trackers are and which one to use for which problem.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, you should talk to your technology manufacturer where you bought your software from. So, for example, if you bought JAWS from Vispero, your first point of call is Vispero.
All right. It's 1:30.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think, Willow, you're going to do the next presentation?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. Hello, come up, please, to talk about Braille.
Hello, everyone. Hi. My name is Willow Free. I work at APH, and I'm a Braille transcriber. My job right now is as a product manager, and I focus on technology, primarily Braille technology. I'm here today to talk about eBraille. I was going to open by asking who hasn't heard of eBraille, but you've all now heard of eBraille, so that's great. Who hadn't heard of eBraille before they came here today? Anyone? Okay, great. So everybody's heard about it. I'd also like to say thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate getting a chance to come speak with you all, and I love talking about Braille and discussing Braille, and I think it's a fun thing to argue about and debate. So, the first thing, especially with where we are, I would like to apologize for the time of our meetings. So eBraille is an international effort. We have over 40 organizations around the world that are working together to help build this standard. Those organizations represent everything from Braille organizations, blindness organizations, companies, individuals, you know, including teachers, Braille users, and transcribers. And when you're trying to have a meeting with that many people from all over the world, you eventually have to pick a time to have the meeting. And unfortunately, the time that we have that meeting is at 14 UTC, which is 2 a.m. in New Zealand. And so I really apologize for that. And I apologize, too, that I didn't make this offer before now. But especially to our folks in Australia and New Zealand, if you would like to organize some type of meeting with me, and I could come talk with you about eBraille, make sure your folks understand, and then also take questions and discussion and take that back to the main working group, I would absolutely love to do that. And my email address is wfree, F-R-E-E, at aph.org. So please feel free to email me. And if you'd like to learn more about eBraille on your own time, you know, things that I'm not going to cover today, you can go to daisy.org/eBraille, and there you can find everything. So we're working on this new Braille standard, and we've done that in, I think, a very careful way. You know, the very first thing we did was we agreed on what problem we were trying to solve. You know, we didn't want to do all this work and then have us get to the end and find out that half of us thought we were going to do one thing when it turned out we were going to do another thing. So we first agreed on what problem we were going to solve, which is, you know, we're going to work to create this new Braille file standard that does some of the things that James talked about earlier. But then we've done everything publicly through GitHub. So we have a GitHub repository, and there you can find all of our issues that have been created. So the problems that we're looking to solve, the discussion we've had about those problems, and then the meeting notes, and we have wikis that detail all of the work that we're doing. So it's pretty dense. It's a lot to take in, but it's all out there. It's all public. And the reason we've done that is it's not just a technical problem. You know, it's not just a technology problem. It's a political problem. You know, it's come up already, but if you're trying to make this universal international Braille file standard, you've got to get folks on board. If they're not on board, and, you know, you can make any file standard you want, and if no one wants to make it and no one wants to use it, it doesn't really matter. And so we've tried to do everything in this very careful way. We've been working for a little over 2.5 years, which is a long time, but typically, creating a new file standard takes about 5 years or more. So we're still coming in pretty quickly, and I will get into the timeline later. So why make a new Braille file standard? James touched on it some. For APH, it really started with the Monarch and seeing where Braille was going. So the Monarch is 32 cells by 10 lines. It's just one multi-line Braille display, though. There's going to be other multi-line Braille displays. Like, this is a thing that is going to happen. We're going to continue to have more multi-line Braille displays. With the way Braille files work today, everything's hard-coded. And so if you continue the way that we're going now, you're going to end up with transcribers making files for specific hardware. And our Braille libraries are going to get segregated into these different hardware types. So you're going to have Braille made for 11.5 by 11 paper, 8.5 by 11 paper, A4 paper, you know, the Monarch at 32 by 10, this other display that may exist at 25 by 8. And it's just going to make Braille harder and harder to read. Because as you open this hard-coded file on your different devices, it's going to give you that long line, short line syndrome that James talked about. And so that's really where it started, but that's not a good enough reason to do this. You know, like, what else can we do? And it was that problem, that need to have a file type that could conform to the capabilities of the hardware that has led to these other possibilities. So that's why we're making basically a Braille EPUB. I really liked James's acronym RING, so I've made my own on the spot, and it's MUG-C. It's not as good as RING. It's not as good as RING. The M stands for markup, and so the markup is where you get that reflowability. So that markup, if you're not familiar with markup, that is basically the tags in the file that tell you what the text is supposed to be. So right now, in most of your Braille files, those don't exist. There typically aren't these tags. You just have the Braille text, and then you've got space telling you what that is as a Braille user. With these tags, now you know this is a paragraph. It's not just this is indented 2 cells and then runs over to the left margin. It's now everything inside these tags is a paragraph. So, you know, in that case, a paragraph tag would just be a P tag. But you're marking up the entire file, and you're going, you know, this is a paragraph, this is a list, this is a table, these are headings, these are page numbers. And that's all work that is separate from what Braille transcription has been in the past. But it's still largely the way Braille transcription works. I was a Braille transcriber for many years, and I still consider myself to be a Braille transcriber, but when I did it full time, That was my entire job, was sitting at my computer with my print copy of the book, saying, this is a heading, this is a list, this is a table. And you listen to a lot of podcasts as a Braille transcriber, but it's good work. And that part doesn't need to change. The transcribers can still do that, but we can save this markup and use it in this new file type. The next letter is Unicode, which you've already heard a bit about with Unicode. There's a lot outside of our control here, but with the current reliance on ASCII, you run into a lot of issues. You know, you're relying on Braille fonts. The user receiving your file has to have the same Braille font as you. You're relying on encoding. There's different encoding systems throughout the world. You know, I tell this story all the time, but I was working with someone in Spain, and they'd sent me their file, and I'm reviewing their file, and we're trying to discuss their file, and we're not agreeing. And I keep saying, like, no, I'm seeing what I think I should be seeing. And they're like, no, I'm not seeing what I should be seeing. And it turned out they were using a completely different encoding than me. And it took us a while to figure that out. And so Unicode gets us away from that problem. We don't have to rely on Braille fonts anymore. We know everyone's using the same Braille characters. And it opens up other possibilities too. You know, Christo brought up a good point. You know, when are we going to see these things? There's a lot outside of our control, but as we push the eBraille standard, as we push these other changes, I think it can lead to better things. Like, I don't know if you've noticed, but screen reader users, screen reader support for Unicode Braille is not very good. It typically just reads the dot numbers. And so we've been having discussions with, you know, different software developers of screen readers to say, like, let's improve Braille Unicode support. You know, you should have the option to hear the dot numbers, to hear the Braille character, or to just hear it translated. And then that way you don't have to rely on having a Braille display in order to review Unicode Braille. But that's, you know, that's just one change that can happen because of this change to the Braille file type. The G stands for graphics, which we've heard a bit about. You know, currently, you know, I can talk about how APH does it, but you have your Braille in a folder. So you have a folder, and in it, you've got a folder with your Braille files, and then you've got another folder with your tactile graphics. And they're completely separate. And if you want to send it to someone, you have to zip it up, and they have to produce them separately. We actually have someone whose job it is to go through the Braille file, and the printed embossed Braille, they go through it and they find the page where a graphic should go, and they throw it out and they fold in where the tactile graphic goes. And I mean, that adds a lot of time. It's a very manual process, which, you know, can lead to mistakes. And it's really because of this separation between the Braille and the tactile graphics. With devices like the Monarch, you know, that can now change. Like, now we have this motivation, like, let's keep our Braille and our graphics together. And the way that works is we're basically making, as James said, a Braille EPUB. So EPUB, I'm not going to sit up here or stand up here and try to say EPUB is this perfect, wonderful file type. It's great. Like, first, you know, the first problem with EPUB, I'll say, is how many people use an EPUB reader? One person uses an EPUB reader. That's the big problem with EPUB. Nobody has EPUB readers. Braille displays sometimes have EPUB readers, and so that's what's sort of attractive about the idea of the EPUB file type. It already has markup. It already handles images. It has support, but the big problem is you send it to the user. The user tries to open it, and if they're using Windows, they'll get that little dialog box that says, what program do you want to use to open this in? And then they're not going to know which program because they probably don't have one. So one of the changes we're making with eBraille is, and it's really technical, and I don't want to get into all the technical details, but one of the differences we're doing with eBraille is making it possible to open in your browser. And so everybody has a browser. I'm not even going to bother asking. Everyone has a browser. And so with your browser, you could open the eBraille file. You could use your screen reader. if you're using like a, you know, an external device like your phone, tablet, or computer, and then a Braille display to review the e-Braille, to navigate through the e-Braille, or if you're using a note taker or something like the Monarch, you can open it on the device and get all of the Braille and the graphics as they exist. And the reason we're able to do this is the last part, which is the C that ruins my entire acronym, and that is CSS. CSS, if you've never heard of it, it stands for Cascading Style Sheets. And it's kind of what it's what makes the internet both beautiful and ugly. So it's really beautiful when it's done well, and it's really ugly when it's done poorly. But it's at the core of what eBraille is, because we're separating the presentation from the content. So the content is the Braille. The content is the Braille. It's the Braille, it's the tags on the Braille saying this is a heading, this is a list, this is a table. And then the presentation is the CSS. So it's the CSS that's saying, so I'm from a Banna country, so I know Banna. I know some about other formats, and we'll talk about that a little in a moment. But I'll use Banna example since that's what I know. CSS is what allows you to say this heading should be centered, it should have a blank before it, and it should have a blank after it. Or this heading 2 should start in the fifth cell, and it should have a blank line before it. Now, what's cool about the way this works, though, is because we're separating the presentation and the content, we've got we've got unified English Braille. We do not have a unified formatting system. And so by doing this, you could take a file made in England using their formatting rules. You could open it in the United States and apply the formatting rules of the United States, and vice versa. And so it would allow us, especially us, you know, because we have unified English Braille, it would allow us to share Braille in this new way that we couldn't before. You know, we're still using Unicode Braille, so the translation is hard-coded, you know, so the language is hard-coded. So that's why I think it's really applicable for UEB countries to have something like eBraille that we can all share and get our same formatting rules applied universally. Now, the reason I think this works, and a part of my paper, is this commonality of Braille formatting. You know, because Braille exists on this kind of fixed grid, there's a limited number of things you can do with it. So there's a limited number of ways that formatting works. And one of the things we did in eBraille, as far as I know, this has never been done. If it has been done, please let me know about it, and please send me the files. But we took a print file, and we had it transcribed by different countries using their rules. And so now we have examples of how different countries are handling the same formatting, the same text. You know, how are they handling these headings? How are they handling these page numbers? And we're able to compare that and see the different possibilities of Braille. And there's really not that many things. I mean, so there's blank lines, there's blank cells, and then there's formations of Braille characters. That's a big one. And these formations of Braille characters, you know, maybe it's the same character repeated over and over, like the guide dots. It could be characters that are slightly different and have to line up with the characters on the line above them or the line below them or something to that effect. But that's one of the more complicated examples. And then the last and one of the really complicated examples is the page numbers in the corners. So we all put the page numbers in different corners. And so having CSS that can say, you know, the page number, you know, the print page number needs to go in the left corner, the top left, and the Braille page number needs to go in the top right, or whatever it is. And then you need to have this amount of space separating the text from those page numbers. That gets really complicated, but it's totally doable. You know, CSS is used online to do all of the number of different things you can do with a web page, and it can just as well do those things for Braille formatting. And it really is a Braille EPUB, and so I just want to talk about that a little more. So you've got your folder. It's all zipped up together. So this isn't finalized yet, but it's all going to be zipped up together, and it will most likely have a file extension of .ebrl. And then inside that, there'll be a folder that has your Braille files. Your Braille files will be XHTML files, which is HTML, if you're not familiar with that, that's what's used for the web. XHTML is a slightly stricter version of that same language. And you know, we're Braille, so we like things that are strict. And then you've got a folder with your CSS, and then you've got a folder with your tactile graphics, and you've got a manifest that holds the whole thing together. And that's what makes it a Braille EPUB. Here's what's really beautiful about that, in my opinion. One of the arguments that I hear against eBraille is, why do we need another Braille file type? Why not have a mainstream file type that we can use? And I think it's, you know, I think it's a fair argument. It was a part of our discussion at the very beginning. You know, should we do a Braille file type or should we do a print-based file type? There was a lot of discussion about it, and I ultimately think there's really valid reasons to go in either direction. Some of the arguments against the print file type that came up, and you know, we can get into the validity of each argument, but you know, one is, you know, is there a pipeline to create these files? So we have Braille transcribers today. We don't have enough, I agree. And sometimes we don't have enough training of the Braille transcribers that we have, but we do have a Braille transcription pipeline. Are we going to teach, you know, if we use a print-based file type, we need some way to create math. And you need to set up the math so that it can be translated by something like LibLui. You can't just put in text, you know, as is. So how do you do that? So do you teach all the transcribers how to do LaTeX? I don't know that the folks are going to be willing to do that. Do we rely on publishers to get it right the first time? That's a scary proposition. I've, you know, part of my career at APH was working on Braille Blaster, and the thing Braille Blaster does best is open other people's file types and convert them for Braille. And in doing that, I got to see how bad these file types can be. You know, one of my favorite bugs that we ever had in Braille Blaster is the PerPal bug. And it was because there was a typo in the file where they'd coded it as PerPal, P-U-R-P-A-L, instead of purple. And so we had to be, as the more we worked on Braille Blaster, the less strict we had to be as we started to see how variable print could be, because it's being made by all these different publishing houses that do not know Braille, do not think about Braille, and I don't know that we're ever going to get them to think about Braille. And so that was kind of the argument against, that, to me, that was the main argument against making a print-based file. However, one of the cool things about eBraille is we have this CSS file. So we have this CSS file. If you wanted to, you could take this CSS file and you could apply it to a print EPUB. And there may be some differences in the markup that will make it not work perfectly well, but those would be easy enough to correct. But if you wanted to, you could take that CSS and apply it to a print file and get Braille formatting from that print file. So we really have this solution that I think sets us up for the way our system works today and for the possibilities of our future. You know, because right now I do think, I agree with James that LibLui is getting better and better, Duxbury is getting better and better, but especially, you know, when I look at the the main focus of APH, which is the students. You can't give students Braille you're not sure is translated correctly, transcribed correctly. It has to be perfect. And so that's the system we have today. And, you know, in the future, who knows? In 5 years, in 10 years, who knows how Braille's going to be made, but it may be possible to rely on computer translated files more readily. And if that's the case, we're already set up to take advantage of that. We're already in a place where we've done the work, we've created the CSS files, we've created the infrastructure. All we need to do now is then apply the things we've done to this new method. So I've talked a lot about possibilities, and I said I would get to Christo's question, which is the timeline. So we're finishing up the first spec. We're very close. We basically have the tagging, we basically have the metadata, and then we're finalizing the CSS. The metadata, which I haven't really talked about, isn't, it's just data about data, and it'll help libraries and it'll help users find the Braille files. So we're finishing up the first spec soon. DAISY has a conference going on in Paris right now, and then we, of course, have this conference, and so those two things are going to delay that first spec coming out a little bit. But I'm thinking within the next month or two, we should be able to publish that first spec. Once we put out the first spec, it's not like we're all going to say, okay, we did it, and go home. We'll still continue to revise. There's a lot of folks, like I was talking to the folks at SMB, you know, they're interested in implementing eBraille potentially, and they want to see that first spec. And they're not going to be the only ones. You know, other companies are going to want to see that first spec. They're going to want to see what eBraille entails, what decisions were made. And I hope they will come back to us in the working group and say, I don't like the way you did this, or I like this part. Can you do more of that? And then we'll take that feedback into consideration, we'll discuss it, and then we'll make changes where applicable. A big principle of eBraille from the beginning is we want the manufacturers, we want the software developers to be involved, but we also don't want to just cater to their needs. You know, we don't want to only cater to them. At the end of the day, this file type is for the users, it's not for the companies. And so, you know, and this is a little dangerous, I guess, to say so publicly, but, you know, companies sometimes don't want to do things that are hard. You know, they want to do things that are going to be cheap and quick because, you know, they've got profit margins and things like that to think of. And so we're not just going to be beholden to what companies want. We're going to be thinking about what's best for Braille and what's best for Braille users. But that'll be a discussion that we have. It'll be just as public as the discussion we've already been having. And we'll continue to revise. And the goal will be to release that final spec. I'm putting some caveat on the word final, but we'll get to that. That final spec in early 2025. So we're relatively close to having this full specification out. Now the caveat on final is the great thing about having a file standard like this is, let's say in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, the landscape has changed and eBraille is no longer sufficient. I don't think any of us want to come together again and try to make a new file type, and we don't have to. Just like HTML is always being updated and EPUB is being updated, we can update eBraille. So if things change, if there's new needs, if there's new changes, we can make those changes to the file type. We can work with everyone, but it won't be, we're not going to have to completely redo this entire process. It'll be a much quicker, cleaner process to make changes if we need to. It's not something we'll do lightly, but it won't be as big a deal as it is now. Now, releasing a file type doesn't really mean anything. All you've done is published a specification that's going to live online, and people may or may not read it. The way you get support is, number one, you need exemplars, which, if you're not familiar with that, these are perfect examples of the file type. So you can, and you want several different kinds. You want them to represent different types of ways this file type can be made. And you basically put those online, you make them available, and then folks, if they, you know, if they want to say they support eBraille, then they have to be able to support those exemplars. If they can't open those exemplars, then they can't say that they support eBraille. You also need a validator. The validator says you can run your file through it, and it can tell you, is this file an eBraille file? You know, does it validate? And so that'll be used by, like Braille Blaster is going to support eBraille. You know, we're in talks with other Braille transcription programs to support eBraille. We have a converter that I'll talk about in a little bit. But that validator will say, this file is an eBraille file, it passes the test. And between the exemplars, the validator, and the support to create eBraille files, that kind of lays the groundwork to get the file type going. And then the last piece is being able to open eBraille files. We've made that path, I think, as easy for ourselves as we can by making it an EPUB. I think we get the support of Braille readers that already, you know, Braille reading software that already supports EPUB. You know, because right now, if you run an eBraille file through an EPUB validator, it'll validate as an EPUB. So it's that's how close it is to being an EPUB. It'll actually validate as an EPUB. So we got that support. And then with the browser support, what's great about that is you could open it in any browser. Now, opening it in just any browser isn't necessarily going to be the ideal reading experience. So, I mean, you could very, you know, relatively easily make plugins, and you could make a bespoke browser, you know, a specialized browser that works really well with eBraille files. There's lots of options, but what's great about it is you don't have to reinvent the wheel just to get this additional support. So those are kind of the pieces of eBraille. You know, the converter, the validator, the support to create, and the support to open. And now you need people to make it. And by going the Braille route, I think we've made that as easy as possible too, because the work that transcribers will do will largely be the same as the work they're doing today. You know, just like I said, you know, I would sit there with my print book and I would say, this is a heading, this is a list, this is a table. And the problem was, as soon as I was done and I went to file and I went to save, all that information got thrown out. Now it's all going to get maintained, all going to get retained. The differences for the transcriber are going to be adding links. So we'll be able to put links into the content, so you can have links in your table of contents. You could have links for your footnotes and endnotes and things like that. And then adding the tactile graphics. So I think there's some barriers there, but I think we've got the barriers as low as we possibly can by making it as similar to the workflow as what people are doing today. And then the last thing is readers. The last thing is you need people to want to use this file type. I'm hopeful, you know, James talked a lot about the features, I've talked some about the features, but I'm hopeful, and I really feel it's true from the folks that are so passionate in the working group about the file type and what it can do, that the readers will also be there. And I hope the folks that want eBraille will demand it, because there is a lot outside of our control. We've got folks that say they'll support eBraille, but we don't have contracts with these folks. It's hard to get people to sign a contract when you're not going to give them any money. And so we need folks to demand eBraille support, and it's through those demands that we will see more and more and more eBraille support. But the last piece I'll talk about is we do have a converter. So this converter takes the BRF files that are used in some ICEB countries, and it can convert them to a kind of proto eBraille file. It's not as good as a born eBraille file, but it's better than the BRF that you started with. It does that by looking at the formatting, and we're developing it at APH. So right now it is working with BANA formatting, but it's open source, And we've designed it from the beginning to make it easy for folks to take it and adapt it to their Braille rules. And so you can adapt it to your Braille rules in your region and get eBraille files that way. You could also build it into your own software. Like, it's open source, so you'll be able to do, you know, almost whatever you want with it. So we've got paths to get eBraille sooner rather than later, and we've got a path forward to have eBraille starting, you know, next year and the year after. Well, does anyone have any questions about any of the stuff I said?
Mr. Free, I just wanted to let you know and thank you most sincerely for inventing Braille Blaster. Thank you also to Chantal Griffiths, who shared that particular software with us, because our Duxbury license broke down when our computers broke down, which is common in Pacific Island countries, and we had a way with the index V4 and V5 word formatting. However, when it came to formatting our Samoan language, which we are still trying to produce the code, it added extra dots or extra signs. So we are extremely grateful to the American Printing House for the Blind for providing Braille Blaster, which has now become an extra option for us. We are also considering looking into Saumai Braille editor in terms of the graphic, the graphics, because we have very little funding, and all these open source screen readers and also NVDA also, they are really our lifesavers. So I hope to just to convey that sincere thanks to your wonderful work. I'm hoping I can meet you when it's tea time just to discuss some things about Braille Blaster if possible. But sincere faftai, and thank you very much for the wonderful work.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I would love to talk at tea time. All right, so I did a perfect job, and I really appreciate you all being here, and thank you so much for this opportunity.
Brain is definitely starting to break down. So we have Leona to talk to us about refreshable Braille and tactile graphics. All right.
Thank you. Get closer. Okay, thank you, Judy, and hello, everyone. So there's many topics that I would love to talk to you about, but today's topic will be refreshable tactile displays, particularly in terms of research and open questions that I think we can all explore together. So I'm presenting on behalf of my co-authors, Professor Kim Marriott, Matthew Butler, Sam Reinders, and Peter Cracknell, who's hiding up the back there. Okay, and when I say refreshable tactile displays, I'm talking about displays that can be used for graphics such as the Monarch, the DotPad, and the Knut, and my focus is on access to graphical information. Okay, so I'd also like to introduce who I mean by we as I talk. So as explained earlier in the demo session, I'm a member of the Inclusive Technologies Group at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, and we are within the Human-Centred Computing Group in the Faculty of Information Technology. So that means that we're doing a lot of user-centred research from a multidisciplinary approach. As I said, our paper was co-written with Peter Cracknell from Quantum RLV, and he brought the perspective of an adaptive equipment supplier with a focus on the potential market for refreshable tactile displays. And it's typical that we work with partners because working with the community is a very important part of our work. Researchers don't know what people want unless we actually not just ask you, but work with you. Okay, and furthering our partnerships as well, the inclusive technology team at Monash University is a group within the newly formed Monash Assistive Technology and Society Centre. So that is bringing together researchers who are interested in assistive tech across all of Monash University, so faculties of engineering, arts, education, business and nursing. So we've got a large body of researchers who can work together on things. Okay, so that's enough of that. My plan for today is to first share some of the research work that we have been doing on the use of refreshable tactile displays and to highlight the key findings so far. And then I'd like to raise some design challenges that I think are important for the adoption of refreshable tactile displays as meaningful tools for delivery of tactile materials, and so that we can all work together to create displays and file formats and all of those things that we've been talking about that work best for everybody. So I don't think I need to explain too much what a refreshable tactile display is or why they're exciting, but I will abbreviate to RTDs just for the sake of time, and also with the understanding that we're taking a very device agnostic approach. So interested in the general capabilities of devices rather than the specifics of one device over the other. Just very quickly, probably the main devices that are available at the moment are the Monarch, or available or coming onto the market, are the Monarch, the DotPad and the Knut. All of those devices are using refreshable pins, and they have fixed dot heights, so they're just one height, and spacing that is similar to a Braille cell. So the Monarch has a grid of 32 cells in 10 rows, is that correct? I'm getting nods at the back, very good. And it has got a Braille keyboard for data entry and editing and lots of other controls. The DotPad is the smallest and lightest RTD that's currently available. It has a grid of 30 cells by 10 rows and an additional 20-cell Braille line for displaying text and labels, but it doesn't have, it's really is just a display rather than a hardware device. The Knut by Bristol Braille is the heaviest device. It doesn't have power inbuilt, and it has 9 rows of 40 cells, and there's fixed separation between those rows, so it does limit its use as a graphics device. And there are other devices that are around, and which have been used more in the research to date because they've been available earlier. So the MeTech is a European device that has quite closely spaced cells, and the Graffiti by Orbit Research is actually the one that we've had access to at Monash University. It has very widely spaced cells, pins, but they do go to 4 different heights. So the devices have got a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of differences in terms of whether the computing is on board or it's acting as a display. Some have got that additional line to display text, whereas others do not. The refresh rates, so that's how fast a pin can move up and down, is different across devices. And the software might be protected or it might be open to developers. The software is at different stages of development. Some of the devices have zooming and panning. Some will do incremental panning, whereas others will do page by page. And some are touch sensitive, and they use different methods to achieve this, but others are not detecting touch. Okay, so that was probably the less interesting stuff. Let's talk about some of the research that we've done. So the first project, and this is the one that I was directly involved in, and so if you're asking questions, ask about this project because I can answer them well. So it was a study published at the 2022 ASSETS Conference on Accessible Computing, and we investigated the use of RTDs for displaying animations because I was really excited that we could finally show an animation as a tactographic. So before we started, we did a survey of touch readers and some accessibility experts to find out whether they were interested in such a thing, and if so, what. And what they told us was that there was most interest in tactile animations as learning support for children and also for adults to access maps. So those were the most things of most interest, which probably is not surprising, and more so than other uses such as sport and entertainment, but those were still of high interest. So based on that, we created a range of animations, and some of them were things that people had suggested themselves. And I am a tactile graphics transcriber in my past life, so I was the one who created the diagrams manually, and I did that for optimal presentation, and I used a dot-by-dot editing software rather than simply importing from another format. The diagrams were displayed on a graffiti refreshable display, and we used the 4-pin heights, which I found was useful in terms of providing more detail than I thought I would be able to achieve. So the heights were useful to distinguish between more important features and less important features. So, for example, on a bar graph, the taller bar graphs could also be higher. They could be used instead of using texture or colour to distinguish between different areas. So for an example, we were showing the growth of a plant and we had the roots up high and the soil was down lower. The heights also used to indicate depth, so we had a figure doing Tai Chi and we could show the limbs coming forward, like in front of the body were at a higher height and behind the body were at a lower height, and that made sense to people and was able to give more information than a tactile graphic. We did, however, find that there were 4 heights on the graffiti and you could only really tell between 3 heights. Okay, so the animations were co-designed with a touch reader, and then the 4 most successful animations were then evaluated by 12 blind adults alongside equivalent tactile graphics. And overall, the RTD was more successful than a sequence of tactile graphics in conveying change and giving a sense of movement, but there was a lot of variation within that. So the refresh rate, so the rate at which the pins come up on the graffiti, is quite slow. So animations worked best when the change was in, the change from one diagram to the next was quite small and in a predictable space or in a small space so that you knew where to feel to get that change. So, for example, we had a sequence of diagrams that show the formation of a waterfall with the water and the drop from down the waterfall moving downwards. So that worked really well because the refresh was going from the top to the bottom as well. So it really made a lot of sense. And another nice example was the formation of a wave that was shown going from the left to the right at where the beach was. And again, it was quite a small area that was changing and it was in a predictable direction. So you did get that sense of movement across the screen. However, there was another diagram that I tried a few different times with a bird with flapping wings. And when I was trying to show those wings going upwards and the refresh was going down, you would have 2 sets of wings and it just really didn't work. So dynamic authoring provided unexpected I'll speak properly, advantages for the RTD over tactile graphics during the study. So that meant that I could adjust the diagrams on the fly when errors were found, or when people wanted the diagrams to be simplified, or when they suggested some changes. We could try that out very, very quickly and immediately look at it, make that adjustment, save it if we thought it worked well. But for the tactile diagrams, I would have had to go back to the lab and make a whole new diagram. And actually, in the space of the study, I didn't get a chance to do that. So it was quite a big difference in terms of how easily I could adapt things. Dynamic authoring, or the use of a blinking cursor or drawing a line, could also be used to direct attention on the diagram. So rather than using hand over hand or hand under hand, we could use the blinking cursor to as a confirmation that you're in the same spot that I'm talking about. And overall, the study revealed interest in the use of RTDs as a new mechanism for showing dynamic content as tactile graphics, but there were trade-offs in terms of resolution and texture. So there were some diagrams where the tactile graphic was preferred because you could get more detail on those tactile graphics. And it showed that there's more research and development needed into optimal design for the devices and also for the graphics that they display. So I really did feel like I was coming up with a new way of showing the tactile diagrams rather than being able to rely on existing guidelines. Okay, so the second study, which is just recently completed and will be the part of a larger project. So this is led by Sam Reinders, who is looking at use of conversational agents like Siri or Alexa or Google Assistant to increase access to data visualizations. And this is the first work that we know of that's combining conversational agents with RTDs. So because the technology doesn't already exist, they conducted a Wizard of Oz study, again using the graffiti refreshable display. So just like in the book or the movie, a Wizard of Oz technique is an experiment where people interact with the system that they think is operating, but actually there's someone behind the curtain sneakily doing what the computer should be doing. So this method lets us observe the way that people want to interact with the system without having to build the system first. So we worked with 11 blind adults who used touch combined with voice commands to interact with a range of data visualizations on the refreshable tactile display, such as line graphs, bar charts, and heat maps. And they found that users often begin with tactile exploration of the visualizations on the RTD, and then they expect to be able to use combinations of touch gestures or direct spoken interactions with the conversational agent to investigate or validate details. So, for example, to ask what is the specific value on their graph at that point. And they definitely preferred using a combination of the RTD with the conversational agent rather than using just one or just the other. But the way that they used it was strongly dependent on the type of task that they were doing and also their confidence with tactile graphics. So people with good tactile reading skills found that using the graph on the RTD gave them more engagement with the data and also supported their independent interpretation. So the third area where we are wanting to move into in terms of research is mathematics. So obviously there's a lot of scope for displaying mathematical content on RTDs. Maths text often runs over multiple lines, and the RTD allows for multiple lines to be felt at once, which replicates the advantage of Braille embossed on paper, which we've talked about already today. So things like spatial layout assists with things like vertically aligned addition and subtraction for young learners. Then there's long division for learners a little bit older, and then matrices for senior mathematics. And in terms of graphics, I think we know the global mathematics curriculum relies on a lot of graphics like bar charts, line charts, scatter plots, graphs of mathematical functions, trigonometry diagrams, et cetera, shapes, all of those things. So automated generation of mathematics graphs using RTDs has been an early area of research, with work focusing on the creation of interfaces between the accessible math software and the RTD. So they've explored requirements for the representation of maths graphs that might be equally relevant to other types of diagrams, such as representing a graph with a single line of dots. Sorry, I need to cough. Sorry. So representing a graph with a single line of dots regardless of the zoom level is a suggestion that was made by prior researchers, and that's something that could apply to other types of diagrams as well. And there's also discussion about the ability to flip a diagram from portrait to landscape layout for viewing on a RTD. So those are things that we need to think about across the board. So the importance of supporting mathematics is also recognised by the developers of RTDs. So as we've seen with the Monarch, they've explicitly integrating graphing calculator functionality. And once the graphs are displayed on the RTD, oh, thank you, they also need to be explored. So you need to be able to interact with them in ways that are easy and intuitive and meaningful. And I think we can do a lot of work in terms of exploring those things. So it could be things like finding coordinates and areas of interest. It could be using flashing pins, selection, zooming, panning, general navigation, all of those things. So we need to do some ongoing work on that. And also things like, are onboard controls needed? Can you use another device to do the controlling? Do you need to use hand gestures to do the controlling and interacting with the graphics? All of those questions. And so taking maths graphs a step further, as we heard from Tina Hertzberg yesterday, creating your own graphs assists with engagement and active learning and understanding. So it would also be great to devise ways in which students can create their own graphs beyond just typing in the equation, but also doing things like perhaps assigning 2 points on a graph and sketching the line between it, or hand drawing lines. All of those sorts of things are exciting possibilities. And we're also interested in whether using an RTD with a visual interface has an impact on communication between the blind students and their teachers and peers in the classroom. Okay, so I've got 1,000 questions and ideas, but we've narrowed that down to 6 main research challenges. So the first is identifying the most important uses for RTDs. So education and mapping have so far received the most attention, but there's also a lot of other potential applications. And I think looking at the workplace use for productivity applications like spreadsheets or presentation slides is a good area to investigate as well. We do have a student who's interested in that, but she hasn't put her hands on an RTD yet, so we'll see if we can get her interested. The second challenge is developing new design guidelines specifically for tactile graphics to be displayed on RTDs. So do we need to be designing them differently from the way that we're designing for a swell paper diagram, for example? Also, things like textures is a really interesting question. So how do you show different areas on an RTD? Do you use dot patterns rather than dots and stripes, for example? The third challenge is determining the most appropriate way to support interactions with dynamic content, which I spoke about a bit before. So animation, zooming, showing sequences of graphics with increasing complexity. That was a really interesting thing that we did in our first study, was start simple and then you can add layers on once you've got understanding. RTDs can also allow access to dynamic data displays. For example, to show sailing speed, wind direction, and a compass bearing on a boat in real time, for example. But we need more research to determine the most appropriate way to support these sorts of interactions with dynamic content. Can you have your hands on things while they're moving? All of what sorts of hand movements should be using as well, I think, is different from a static tactile graphic. The fourth challenge is exploring the role of multimodal interactions and interfaces. So having audio labels with your graphic, using sonification in combination with your graphic as well, and as I talked about, conversational agents. So what is the best way to label diagrams that are designed for use on an RTD? And the fifth challenge is developing new authoring tools and methods. So as I said, the study that I did, I was doing dot by dot editing of those diagrams, and I really felt like there was a much better way. I just didn't have access to it. And we need, for teachers particularly, to have a very quick and easy way to produce diagrams that will be shown optimally on the RTD. And maybe AI is a possibility as long as we lead that work and do it in a way that is based on best practice rather than what that is easiest for the programmer at the time. And so the last challenge is designing the necessary hardware and software to support all of these challenges. So we don't yet have an understanding of the sweet spots in the design space. So, for example, we don't understand the impact that spacing of pins has on the perception or the trade-offs between larger, more expensive displays and cheaper displays with fewer pins, zooming, panning, all of those things. And okay, I think I've mentioned most of those things. All right. So in summary, RTDs have got the potential to transform the availability of Braille and tactile graphics, but successful adoption of these devices, particularly given their cost, relies on the development of optimal devices, software, and processes that really fit our needs. So now is the time that all of us, as researchers and producers and touch readers, technology companies, Braille experts, to get together and work on these research challenges as a community and help to drive future developments to best fit our needs. And so that is all from me for now. I'm not going to ask for questions, I'm going to ask for discussion because I feel like I don't have the answers, but we all might do so together. Thank you. Does anyone have a question, or you want to get to afternoon tea? Ari?
Thank you very much, Leona. Is there a way that you can also show practically, because some of us do not really understand some of your concepts that you are, but do you have any pictures, or do you have any things like that, so that those who can see that we've brought along can also have a look, or we can have a feel? Thank you.
That is a very, very good question. So I did not bring a RTD with me because I had a lot of other stuff you might have seen. But I did bring the files that we used for the animation project, and I haven't had a look at whether I can see them on the Monarch, so it would be interesting for all of us to have a play with that.
Sorry, Leona. This is Tino. I'm just wondering, with the devices that you've been demonstrating, I'm just wondering whether there was any discussion as to which of those devices can be affordable. I'm speaking on behalf of the small island states, can be affordable for our colleagues who are blind and visually impaired out there.
The Canute is the most the cheapest, I think, that's available. But as I said, it has the gaps between the lines. They've been doing some really interesting ideas about how you can use it for graphics, but it's not going to show what you would traditionally think of as a tactile graphic. So you won't have that whole grid of pins. And I think the dot pad then is the next most affordable, but it really is a quickly changing field. And as I said, I don't want to be here to advertise one one device over the other. I think that we all need to contribute to the development of these devices and show where the demand is as well. Yes. It's FM on the US table.
I was interested in what you said about whether there may be other ways of encouraging people to use their hands on these dynamic devices. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit more about some of the things that you were thinking about or what you discovered?
So I guess because the resolution is quite low, because I was working on a graffiti and the resolution on that is quite low, I was then making things large but wanting people to feel the changes on the whole, so they were having to use their hands spread out and flat and could keep their hands still and feel the movement of the pins rather than having to move the hands. So it was quite a different way of interacting, but I don't know if it was a successful way of interacting. Yes, we need to figure it out.
Yeah, I don't think it had occurred to me that, because I think I've only seen these devices used for static images and not for dynamic images and so mm-hmm. and animations. Mm-hmm. So I think that may really make quite a difference in how people explore them.
Yeah, and a lot of devices as well don't have that strength to lift the pins up when your hand's on it. So that's then another issue of taking your hands off and putting them back on and knowing that you're still in the right spot or the same spot. Matthew's got a question at the front.
Hi, Leona. Thank you very much for that presentation. I have one tomorrow about multi-line braille displays, so it's really good to hear the tactile graphics side of this in advance. I was really interested, actually, by what you were saying about the graffiti and the variable dot heights, because you can do those on embosser-produced graphics as well, but you need certain types of embossers. And so I've never really thought about variable dot heights as being particularly useful. And it was really interesting that you found that they were. I wondered if you tried on devices that didn't have variable dot heights, whether you tried any other way of trying to distinguish between different types of lines, whether you've been able to play with, say, line thickness or dashed lines versus dotted lines, or making the dots a bit further apart, and how much experimentation you'd done there.
Yes, so I think I was playing with the device with Bill, who's up the back there, and he suggested using different patterns. So some, like every second dot, for example, for a fill pattern, and that worked quite nicely. I think for a lot of those things that I was talking about, like distinguishing the foreground from the background, you would really have to just say, I'm not going to have filled shapes at all, I'm only going to use outlines, which I feel is more difficult to understand.
Hello, this is Ivan from Spain. I would like to find out if there has been made a research about compatibilities exactly on formats of tactiles. I was thinking now they've been mentioned the one from Vietnam, the Mao format or the Ibrei format on graphics, and I was thinking even in Biblos, another ones. So what? How do they behave one another? Do they, in a way, do they accept if there's compatibility among them? And then another thing I was thinking, just for the sake of researching, would it be possible to research how it would be possible to create animations like dots going up and down, quicker than usually, or kind of vibrating, or even going higher and even deeper, like if it was, like going down a slope and things like that. Thank you.
I've forgotten the first question already. Sorry? File formats. I think I don't know the answer to either of those questions. Like I said, I don't know all of the answers. Definitely we're advocating for everything to be open source and for us to be, for things to be device agnostic as opposed to designing things specifically for one device. And I can see a hand up there from Willow. So thank you. Do jump in.
Thanks. So on the like question of file formats, like with eBrail, we have the same idea of like being device agnostic. And so the four tactile graphic file types that we've kind of settled on are JPEG, PNG, PDF, and SVG. The first three all have their own drawbacks, but they are what is used today. And so it felt like we had to support those. The last one, SVG, I think is the best one because it's scalable. But we wanted to stay away from proprietary formats. We wanted to stay away. Like PRN is a file type some folks will be familiar with. PRN is literally just a printer instruction. And so when you make a PRN, you're making it specifically for a specific embosser. And so it's not a very adaptable file format. So I hope that's helpful.
And the second question was about different ways to show animation, like vibration. We did definitely find that like vibrating pins or quickly going up and down was a really way of drawing attention to an area. Last call. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.
It's 2:41, so I propose that we come back at 3:15. At 3:15, Matthew and Clive are going to lead a 90-minute discussion about UEB, just an open discussion about UEB and UEB tech and UEB anything and everything. So let's come back at 3:15.